once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And this today is Saturday, July 19th, 2014. And the telephone numbers to call in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Anywhere else within the sound of his voice.
Or your voice, or my
voice. Somebody's
voice,
or something like that. Or you can go to www. Which stands for something to do with George W. Bush, I think. www. You got to say that right. Dot myktem.com.
Yeah, but you can't contact us through there.
No, but you can go there and listen to us, and then you can call us.
Well, if they didn't know how to listen to us, they couldn't hear us tell them how to listen to us.
Are you getting awful uppity there, young
fella? So not only are we a radio program, in case you haven't figured that part out.
We're programmed.
We are also, or the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm out of Salado, Texas.
Yeah, we're in Temple right now, so we're definitely out of Salado.
Right, we are definitely out of Salado, Texas.
Yes.
Yes.
Way out. Anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, long-time listener. Maybe you guys can explain something to me. I believe it was the middle of last year, or it could have been earlier. The Fed mentioned they were thinking about considering that perhaps maybe they were going to start buying bonds, and the market tanked.
Yep.
And then a couple of weeks ago, I believe, the Fed under Yellen said, we're definitely going to stop.
And we're doing it right
Here's
now.
Here's our timetable.
And the market, broke records.
Gone nowhere but up. But to
right.
me, it was the same message, but with two different results. Can you kind of explain why?
Sure. The easiest answer is that people are not very smart. As a whole.
Well, if you'll recall, at the time we said this is good news because it means the economy is getting better, and the people who are investors who want to bolt and run for the woods are listening to the wrong people.
Yeah, there's an old saying that if you take a crowd and you average the IQ of the crowd, and then you divide it by the number of people in the crowd, you get the actual IQ of the crowd.
It's actually a mob.
Right. In this case, a mob. When Yellen was talking about the possibility of considering the possibility of possibly doing something, how many layers can you put on that? Our economy was not...
Actually, it wasn't Yellen who said it. That,
no, it's Bernanke was saying
yes.
it at that point. The market tanked because people looked around and said, wait, our economy's not in a good enough position to raise rates or to stop the, to ease the easing.
I have an alternative to
that. What is that?
When daddy says, we're going to cut back, we're thinking about cutting back, everybody's terrified.
Right.
When mama says, we're cutting back, everybody says, yay, okay, yes, what, yes, ma'am.
That's something along those lines. When Yellen said it, and this is something that cracks me up every time, when the Fed raises rates, it's because the economy's doing well. When the Fed stops easing the quantitative style, it's because the economy's doing well. And that tends to overshadow the act of the easing or the raising of rates. When the economy's not doing well, and we begin to talk about when the economy's doing well, this is what we're going to do, it's kind of like talking to some college students that are in over their head in debt, and they are not in their career yet. They're looking ahead, and they're going, man, it's going to be nice when I get started to work, and I can make money and start paying this stuff down. And they're... student loan company calls up and says, this is what your payment's going to be when you get out of college. The college student panics. They go, oh my goodness, I am never going to make that. I don't make any money right now. Where am I going to come up with that? And then when they actually do start having to pay it, they go, oh, well, I'm making some money from the thing that I took the loans to learn how to do.
We go through a really fascinating long-term cycle. And we repeat it again and again and again. And it has to do with the fact that the people who, most investors are pretty short-sighted. Fortunately, there's a significant number who are not. but most investors are pretty short-sighted. And we go through this period of intense fear, which we were in a couple of years ago, when anything that happened, if you'll notice, like if for instance, an aircraft had been shot down over Ukraine, the market would have tanked.
Well, it did actually drop the day after following.
And
so, I mean, hey.
Promptly went back to breaking records
again. Yeah, it's right back up there.
And every little thing was causing people to panic. And the reason they were panicking is because they remembered back in 2007, 8, and 9 when everybody was optimistic that they had failed to panic. So if you failed to panic in 2007 or 8, it makes perfectly good sense that you should panic in 2013.
No.
Right?
Well, and maybe in an emotional sense.
Well, you've got to make up for all that lost panic.
And now
people are becoming confident again, which means that they realize they missed out on their confidence a few years ago, and they're starting to make up for it by having confidence today.
Right. Well, I have
an
important point to bring up here, and it's based on what you said to us when you first called in, caller. If you recall, you said something, and it actually gives me some fear for your rationality.
Uh-oh. No. This guy is one of the most rational people.
Well, I have some fear because he says he's a longtime listener.
Okay. Oh, he talks some, too, let me tell you.
Can I ask a second question?
Sure.
When rates do start to go up, are there any asset classes that you run from and then buy into? And I know you've talked about bonds and stuff, but are there any other asset classes that you should?
It's a good idea to become disinterested. It's a good idea to become disinterested at that point.
Yes. What we would say is get out of those asset classes before the rates go up. So don't wait.
Yeah, if you wait when rates, what you just said is the normal reaction. When rates go up, bonds will drop.
So we should get out when the rates go up.
Right. Some people will start to run. Other people will say, well, this is just temporary because they had faked us last year. And they'll stay in there. And what will happen over time in any asset class is as the asset class starts to drop cyclically, which is it's going back down to its long-term mean, and it's going to go right on past it, by the way, gradually people will cease their emotional attachment to that asset class, and they will start out. Well, the people with the most emotional attachment and the least cognitive, the least thought on the issue, the least actual thinking rather than feeling, will be the last ones out. And you can always tell the bottom of an asset class cycle is when those emotionally attached people bolt for the door. That's when you should be buying.
Yeah, so let's say you asked about another asset class. And I wouldn't call it an asset class, but a lot of people do. We'll call it a sector instead. Utilities. People are saying, well, I'm getting out of bonds because of the interest rate sensitivity, so I'm going to get into utilities. No. No. You're talking about almost the same kettle. You're not even getting out of one pan and getting into a pot. You're getting out of one kettle and into the same looking kettle just a step away. They function in this sort of scenario almost identically. And a lot of people are going to the utilities thinking, hey, this is going to be safe when bonds change and so on. No, it's not.
Yeah,
those are the areas that we're looking at and going, don't do that.
There's only one place to go. And again, we have to bet on the future. We have to say, here's what's most likely to happen in the future. And then we have to hedge the bet. So it gets sort of interesting. But there's only one place that's relatively safe to be that's interest-bearing in a rising interest rate environment. And considering every member of the Federal Reserve in the last week has now said we're going to be raising interest rates, I think that's kind of a subtle signal from the Fed that maybe interest rates will go up.
Very, very subtle.
Very subtle, right.
Like, can be right in your face subtle.
But the point is, if you're in a really short-term interest position, meaning short-term bonds, money markets, something that's earning very little today and nobody really wants, then as interest rates rise, the interest rate you receive will rise. And the longer the term on the interest-bearing security you have, the greater the effect rising interest rates will have on it.
Now, that sounded a little bit like a math puzzle. So at what time did the train leave the station before.
It all depends on if you were in Germany or the United States.
Right. So basically what he said.
Gentlemen, excuse me. My car's ready. I got to hang up.
All right. Thanks for the call. Right,
yeah, that's interesting. His car's ready.
Yeah. Basically what the summation of what you just said is the longer term the bond, the more dangerous it is when interest rates move.
Up.
Up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the better it is when interest rates move down.
Right. So what has been a good thing up till now, getting into long-term bonds, is a bad thing going forward.
And then there is a wild card in the middle of this that I wanted to talk about today.
Is it like a draw for Uno wild card, or is this just a...
This is a really big wild card. Matter of fact, it's its whole deck.
Oh, okay.
Whole deck of wild cards.
All right. That sounds wild.
One of the things that has been a conundrum, which is something that's confusing and people can't figure out the answer to, is why interest rates fell part of last year and the first half of this year.
Oh, I didn't think that was a conundrum.
You didn't?
No.
Okay, why do you think they fell?
Because they didn't go up and they didn't stay flat.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
But what was the cause of them not going up and not staying flat?
Oh, well, that's a conundrum.
Okay.
I got you there.
And the results are beginning to emerge in some studies. And really, we started moving, and we do this in a slow motion, a glacial fashion, but we started looking at moving out of intermediate term bonds, and we're largely out of that now. We started looking at that a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we expected by now we would see rising interest rates. And instead, a year ago, a little less than a year ago now, the 10-year Treasury note, which is the benchmark for everything else, was about 2.963% range. We saw that, and believe me, a lot of major economists who are a lot smarter than all of us put together, which doesn't say a lot, but that's all right.
Divided by what?
Really expected, you know, they said, okay, 3%, that's about right. And by now, they were expecting to see it rising up closer to like 3.2, and then by the end of this year being up at 3.5. But instead, it went down to where it is, you know, the 2.5% range, 2.75% range, and it's kind of wandered around in that area, and nobody could figure out why. Well, they just came out with the data on why that happened.
Well, I'd like to hear. I've got some ideas as well.
Well,
I'd like to hear.
Data is there. The Chinese.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Right, the Chinese basically have been buying. They have, in the first half of 2014, they bought an absolute record quantity of Treasury notes. And at the same time, they're not only buying more than they've ever bought before. That in enough is pretty significant. But they are shifting as shorter-term T-bills roll over.
Yeah.
And T-bills aren't all 90 days, by the way. Some of them go out quite a bit longer. And by the way, the yield is like 2.54% on 10-year Treasury. So what they're doing is they're taking... When a T-bill rolls over, on which they are getting, you know, when they loan us the money, they're getting virtually zero interest, they are buying 10-year treasuries at this point to replace it, which drives the interest rates on 10-year treasuries down, currently, like I said, about 2.5%. And at the end of 2013, they were 3%. What happens is the Chinese... finally admitted they were doing it, and they said something fascinating.
Well, what do you mean finally? They said they were going... We actually, on this radio program back in February, we said that the Chinese had announced that they're going to up their purchases, and they're going to be purchasing more than the Federal Reserve is dropping on its easing. And that's actually... I expect that to continue through the rest of the year.
And
it's just that the easing is going to be speeding up, and there may actually be a raise in interest rates in the process, at which point it'll pass that as well.
Well, this is the interesting thing. If it all depends on how China does. If China continues to have a huge trade surplus,
right?
And here's where it gets interesting, and I may go into this next week again or something because it's a pretty complicated issue. When China has a trade surplus and we have a trade deficit with China, if that's all there was, and that's what a lot of people have thought of with you, that's all there is. Well, obviously, all the money in the United States will drain into China eventually and will collapse.
Right. It's basically, if you have two pots of water and one of them is leaking and the other one is receiving the water, the other one's going to fill up and one's going to go. Yeah, that's just the way it
Except
looks.
Except
it's not happening
It's
that
been
way.
Going on for 20 years and it didn't happen.
Right. And in fact, that there is now more water in the leaky kettle than there is in the non-leaky
yes.
kettle.
And what happens is, when we buy things from China and we pump money, we're effectively causing money flow from the United States into China. That would tend to raise the value of their currency
yeah.
because there's more money in there now than there was before. So the yuan or renminbi, I'm not sure why they call up two different things, but I'm sure there's
some. Well, we have a lot more than one name for ours. We have dollars and bucks and...
Well, I mean, the official names are both of those things. Maybe one it means money and one means the denomination. So dollar and money supply. Anyway,
yeah.
But the price of, if they were simply to absorb that money into their economy that we send there when we buy things from them, then the value of their currency would rise and their goods and services that they offer to the United States would become more expensive and would balance everything out. Well, they haven't done that. What they do is they take this excess money and they effectively, using their banking system, which belongs to the state there, absorb the money, using interest rates to do this, and then they use it to send it back to the United States.
This is
the form of loans to us.
Right. There's one other key point here. The flow of money into China isn't just from the United States. It's also from Germany and France.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the other big trading partners. And the German and French money going into the Chinese system is then sent over to the United States.
In the form of dollars.
In the form of dollars, because that's what their currency is based on.
Now,
so,
and here's the interesting thing for those of you who follow this in any form or fashion.
The rest of this was not interesting
well,
at all.
Well, you know, all this stuff is kind of nice to know stuff, and it's just how the system works and all of that. But there's a lot of angst about the Chinese holding a phenomenal quantity of U.S. debt.
And they have a lot of U.S. debt.
Well, they have $1.27 trillion.
That's what I meant by a lot. There's a lot.
I'm saying, when you consider that our gross domestic product is around $15 or $16 trillion right now.
Right.
That's like saying if you made $160,000 a year and you owe one particular bank $1,270.
I see. I don't look at it the same way.
No, I'm taking it back. Let's see, 1.216. It'd be $12,700, $12,700 because you bought a car, but you make $160,000 a year. If the bank calls your loan, are you going to be in deep trouble? And the answer is no, not really, because
I would look at it a different way.
Okay.
The government of the United States does not make the GDP of the United States. The government of the United
yeah,
States...
Yeah, but it has access to it.
It does... Well, yeah, I accept that if it taxed it 100%, it would go to zero. Nobody would earn anything if the government was taking it all. We would just stop working. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. So the concept here of how much money the government is making is important, because if we raise taxes too much more than where we are, we talked about this last episode...
Mm-hmm.
The revenue is going to come down.
But here's my point. In our family, for example, I have a personal budget and a personal reserve. And my family, our household, has a different budget and a different reserve, okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, you can add, but when you look at our household, it's just one, really.
Right. But if your household
and
took all of the revenue of your business,
your business would
fail.
The other way around. What I'm saying is... when we look at the debt, if I have a debt, I look at it versus my total assets and my total income. I don't look at it versus, well, I've only got this much money spare to pay it. And the issue, but again, it is what I'm trying to say is, when compared to the wealth and the income of the United States, the total money we owe China in every form and fashion, which is mainly government debt, because we really don't owe them, any money of any significance on the corporate side.
In fact, in the corporate side, they owe us a lot of money.
So we're in this position where the Chinese people are afraid, and I've heard a lot of people terrified for some reason, that, well, what happens if the Chinese decide to sell off their treasuries all of a sudden?
Well,
wouldn't that wreck the United States? No.
No, it wouldn't. But it would wreck the Chinese.
It would destroy China.
China's currency is based on that debt.
Yep.
That's how they stabilize their currency. If they decided to sell all of it at once, one, it would have an impact on the price of those bonds. The bonds would drop through the floor. Because putting that much on the market all at once would cause there to be too much on the market. The price would drop. China would get a lot less than it put into it.
Except the Federal Reserve could buy the entire Chinese debt without batting an eyelash.
Right, it wouldn't really affect their holdings. I mean, they have nearly triple the holdings already, and they have plenty on reserve they can step in and do.
Matter of fact, the only entity on the planet large enough to buy any significant portion of the Chinese debt is the Federal Reserve of the United States.
Right. So as far as the stability goes, what you were saying, the stability of or instability, the threat of instability from the Chinese, if they did that, it would be a self-destruct button. And it would have an impact on our economy. I want to make that clear. Only it would be a psychological impact, but it would have an impact. It wouldn't be based on the structure or the monetary supply in the United States. It would be based on, why did they do that? There's a reason behind what they did, whatever it was, because they know that's going to destroy them, so why would they do it?
But this is another interesting point. The total holdings of treasury debt by the Chinese government is less than the Federal Reserve bought in the last 12 months on the open market.
Right.
So
right.
What I'm trying to say is, when people are afraid, well, what if the Chinese sell off the debt? Well, it would be really, really bad, because China would collapse, and that would cause a great deal of instability among the largest nation on the planet, which is not good for anybody.
Well, the largest by population.
Well, nations are people.
Right. Well, I mean, they're also real estate, because Russia is still the largest nation on the planet. Except by population, it's China. Do you know what the number three largest population on the planet is?
I think you just changed the subject.
Oh, I'm just...
What is the number three? Malaysia?
Nope.
Indonesia?
Nope.
India?
Nope.
Okay.
India's number two.
What's number three?
The United States.
Doggone it.
It's strange, isn't it? It's one of those weird things where we don't consider ourselves to be very large, because we're nowhere near the size of India or China as far as population. Well, we're talking about 320 million people. That's a pretty good number.
Which is almost as many people as the Chinese have as migrant workers.
Right, yeah. The migrant population in China.
364 million migrant workers.
Right. The first two sizes are so much larger than the third that it's hard to compare the two. But anyway, what you were saying, the stability in China is based on the United States. If they try to threaten that, then their stability goes away.
The rain in Spain falls mainly in the plain.
Right. Although what that had to do exactly with
the stability in China lies mainly in the stability in the United States.
It doesn't rhyme as well.
I know, but that's why I said something that rhymed, because it was much more interesting.
Right. It's basically, you can quote poetry and then say something that has nothing. I got it. All right. I understand. Well, I have something.
You could actually sing that thing that I said.
There's
the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Yeah, you could do that.
You could do that. See, you can't. There's no way you could say the money in China stays mainly in U.S. treasuries.
Why would you want to sing?
I don't know. You know.
We are weird. Okay.
Yes, but we're really good at it.
U.S. drug maker.
U.S.?
U.S.
You said U.S.
U.S. Us. The us
is that
of
the opposite,
America.
Is that the opposite of like an I-us?
Could be.
Okay, go ahead. U.S.
The us of America.
Right.
The drug maker Abivi has finally won the bid to buy Shire. Are you familiar with this?
This is really esoteric, yes.
Well, is it? It's a $55 billion deal.
Is this the Shire?
Well, it's not Hobbiton, if that's what you're asking.
Well, it could be.
They may have hairy feet there in Dublin, but no, they're probably not hobbits. Do you know why it's going on?
Why is it going on?
Because they're going to move their headquarters to Dublin. A U.S. drug maker, one of the leading drug makers.
Pharmaceutical corporation. Well,
they're drug dealers. Legal drug dealers, good drug dealers, but they do deal drugs.
Yeah, well, it's a pharmaceutical corporation.
Right. So the Knights are...
Which has to do with farms.
Right. The reason why they're moving is because even if they're taxed at Britain's rate, which is what tends to happen a lot of times with Shire's stuff.
Okay, well, this is actually in
it's in Dublin.
Which is in Ireland, which is Ireland's rate, which is a lot less.
A lot less than Britain. But even if they're taxed at the British rates, which is most of Shire actually gets taxed in Britain rather than Ireland.
Which is very confusing.
Right. Their max tax rate is 26%.
Mm-hmm. It's 38 here.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about a large difference. And so we talked about this in last episode, and I wanted to throw in that it's happening still. It's a regular thing. Major U.S. companies are leaving the United States because their corporate tax rate's too high.
And it only costs them $55 billion.
Right. They're willing to pay $55 billion to leave the United States because
legally,
the tax rates are going to be higher than $55 billion here.
Yep, yep. Okay, so we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, ever since the economy started taking off again, you hear these stories or read these stories about people cannot find enough skilled labor, therefore they can't grow their business, et cetera.
Yep.
How much of that is the cause of the economy not growing robustly, or is that just noise? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, I even know why. Thank you very much for calling. Good question.
This is a great question. This is something we can both get excited about.
Unfortunately, the answer to it is not simple.
Well, I can give you a simple answer.
What's that?
We'll begin with just the baseline. When the economy fails, as it has recently, as it did in 2007 through 2009, a lot of people get put out of work. That's pretty simple. Okay.
This man has a very keen grasp on the opposite.
But wait, there is more. Those people that get put out of work sometimes are very highly skilled people. If they can't find a job right away, a lot of them will start their own businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will stop working.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will take jobs that are in an area that's not in their field.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard to leave a job after you have lost a job. So, you follow that?
I'm tracking so far. My brain, a couple of switches flipped out right there.
Right.
I'm resetting the circuit breakers.
If you are a highly paid employee and you're happy with your job and you're going about your business and you lose your job through no fault of your own and it takes you a while to find another job.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find the other job, it isn't in your field. You're not getting paid as much, so you're not as happy with it. But you're still terrified of that period where you didn't have a job.
You have a tendency not to move back to the better-paying job.
Right. You have a tendency to say, wait a minute, I'm going to take my time doing that. That's one of the aspects. The other aspect is they may have started their own business,
in
which case they're bringing in all the people that they knew that were in their field that also lost their job, and now they're looking for more because the business has grown.
A couple of members of the Federal Reserve mentioned some studies at the Federal Reserve has just recently completed and published, which, by the way, when members of the Federal Reserve actually mention these studies, that means they're very significant.
Right.
A couple of things. First, the dropout rate in the labor force has pretty much bottomed out. We are seeing fewer and fewer people, lower and lower effect of people who have stopped looking for work.
Okay.
But the retirement rate, meaning the number of boomers, baby boomers mainly, who have left the workforce permanently because they had enough money, they invested or whatever, or they have a pension, they have enough money, they really don't feel like they need to work anymore,
right,
is the biggest cause of the reduction in the percentage of the population actually working. Okay,
right.
Now, you got all of that.
And a lot of the skilled labor that we're talking about when it is in the industrial area, most of that skilled labor is with older people.
Yeah, and those people may have continued to work if their pay went up, and they may just by inertia. But when they were laid off, they've learned to live on what they've got.
On bread alone. No, not on bread alone.
So that is part of the answer. But the biggest single piece of the answer to your question about the inability to find skilled labor is the federal student loan program.
Yep.
What's happened is...
Boy, does that sound like we changed the subject. We did not. It's absolutely not a change of subject.
The student loan program has been... Having student loans is not bad. Having even guaranteed student loans is not bad. What is bad is the fact that it was seen as a hog trough by Congress, and congressional delegations from, for example, Arizona, who have a great deal of sway in the House right now because they're John McCain, and they are the heart of the conservative movement in the House, and John McCain, of course, in the Senate is very senior, have been firmly behind student loans can go to anybody who can teach a class, whether or not it's quality, and despite the fact, as is with the University of Phoenix, only 16% of the students graduate. This tremendous outpouring of money is a supply of money, and demand will rise to meet the supply in this case. What happens
is... We're seeing a student loan bubble. Mm-hmm. When I say that, college costs are following the same trend that real estate did before mm-hmm. the bust.
But here's the key. The lowering, at the same time, the for-profit, such as the University of Phoenix, the for-profit college and university programs and technical programs have proliferated phenomenally. They have been steadily lowering their standards. They have huge corporations. The Apollo Corporation owns a host of them, for example, and has tremendous lobbying capabilities and has tremendous capabilities to influence the accreditation organizations. And so what's happening is people are getting high levels of education. Theoretically, they're getting the piece of paper. But what happens is when they show up for the job, they can't do the work because they don't know how to do the work because their education was insufficient. They passed the course. They regurgitated the information. But when they actually show up in the workplace to do the things that need to be done, in many cases, they haven't got a clue how to do it. And as a result, that is, you know, what's happened is at the government level, they said if we can get more people with bachelor's degrees
right.
and more people with master's degrees, obviously people will be better off. But it's not working.
Right. It's the same thing that was said. If we can get more people to own houses, we're just going to make it really easy to own a house, and that will make everything better. It doesn't matter if they can't pay. It doesn't matter where the house is. It doesn't matter if they have a job that makes them move every 2 years. They need to own a house.
And these simplistic answers almost never produce a good result and very commonly produce a very, very negative result.
And that's what we're seeing. We actually have some commercials that we need to play.
We do?
Yeah, but this is I don't feel like we've completely finished this subject. We need to come back to it again when we're done with the commercials.
Do you think we'll ever completely finish this?
Just like college.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
But that is only completely accurate if this is Saturday, July 19th, 2014. On other days, the telephone numbers may or may not be those numbers, and you probably will not be able to contact us.
I think that summed it up nicely.
Because we could have an echo through time.
Time paradox.
And we could be talking and saying we're live and today is today. When it isn't today, it's actually a different date.
If today is not July 19th, 2014, I'm my own grandpa. As the Muppets would say.
You're your own grandpa.
Yes. It's a quite a good song if you want to Google that. I'm My Own Grandpa. It is a song about a time paradox performed by the Muppets.
I think that the Muppets could perform a time paradox. You know?
It's quite good.
Absolutely. Anyway, telephone number is near 773-1400, like I said, and?
1-866-597-1400.
So, there's a bunch of stuff out there. Let's see. We haven't even mentioned what happened with the Jow Dones.
The Jow Dones. It is at 17,100.
The industrial average.
Yes.
Dow Industrials end week above 17,000 on earnings-based optimism.
Earnings-based optimism.
That's what that headline in Barron's was. I thought it was really cool, you know. The headlines are actually fascinating to me anyway.
I love reading headlines. I don't even want to read the stories sometimes. I just read the headlines and go, ooh.
The positive finish came despite a big dip on Thursday. I like that, you know. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Say, last week you were talking about the Federal Reserve losing control of setting the interest rates to a Senate House Committee or a House Committee.
Yeah, and I sincerely hope that
doesn't
happen.
And there was an article in the Wall Street about that this past week, and Yellen was pushing back against that.
She was pushing back pretty hard with good cause.
Yeah. With good cause.
Yeah, you have a question?
Well, do you think the House will be able to pass that, or how will that go?
I have kind of a feeling about it. I've looked at that.
Yeah, I think it's possible that it'll get out of committee, but I don't think it'll pass the floor. If it does pass the floor, it won't pass the Senate.
And the interesting thing is it's being hung on a bill to change the Federal Reserve has requested to change the way they regulate large insurance companies to give them a little more flexibility. And the Senate bill passed overwhelmingly, and it's a good bill. The Fed asked for it. It's economically good. It makes a lot of sense as a change to Dodd-Frank. And the House has decided to hang this. Okay, if you're going to allow the Fed a little more flexibility, we're going to lock the Fed into fixed formulas that they can't deviate from so that the next time we have a crash, it'll be a really big one. And even if it gets out of the House with those amendments on it, it's not going to. And the other, there was another thing they hung on it to, which basically says the Fed has to reveal everything it's doing all the time to Congress. And the Federal Reserve says, no, we need to have an independent bank that's not influenced by political leanings, no matter whether it's the right or the left. And, of course, the irony is, and not only is this terrible economic policy to do this, it's disgusting from my perspective, but the point is so amazingly short-sighted. The assumption by the Republicans who are part of the conservative caucus who are pushing for this, the assumption is that the conservative Republicans will control the House forever. And as a result, they can then dictate what the Federal Reserve will do, which will dramatically influence their ability to get reelected. The fact is that down the road somewhere, the Democrats will control the House of Representatives. Are they really interested in turning the Federal Reserve over to the Democrats? And the point is, the Federal Reserve right now is not in the hands of either the Democrats or the Republicans, and that's really where it needs to stay, and it's just astonishingly short-sighted. But anyway, I hope that answers your question.
Right. Well, do you know how does John Carter stand on this? What does he think?
I really don't know. He's not on the committee that is dealing with that, so he's probably not going to express any opinion on it. And if you write him and he writes you back, the answer that you get will leave you more confused than when you wrote him.
Right. Usually the letter that is responded is a form letter of some kind that says, yes, we read your message and really didn't really read it because we're just answering the way that we answer everyone.
They will figure out, for instance, if you have written in before and you are pretty much to the right. You will hear about states' rights and cutting the budget and not raising taxes when they respond to you.
Which is not a whole lot to do with the Federal Reserve.
No,
when you think about it, that, you know, that's not in the same realm of...
You know, if you write him on something that he is personally involved in on his committee, which is the Transportation Committee, for example, and the Appropriations... Is he Appropriations or...
I have to look.
Anyway, you're going to get some... You're going to get a pretty nuanced answer that's going to make probably a great deal of sense. But he can't be an expert or take a position on things before they actually come up to deal. He'll probably defer to other people. Does that make sense to you?
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. You know, it's one of the things that happened this week is the House finally cobbled together an amazing compromise. And the compromise was, interestingly enough, mostly between the various wings on the right side on how to keep the highway fund non-bankrupt after about 2 weeks. They managed to kick it out, but this is how they did it. They kicked it out about a year. This is how they did it. Mainly they took money out of pension funds.
Yeah.
Federal pension funds.
Yep. Just there's a little bit of here, a little bit of there, and oh, there we go. We got enough money.
Put it into the highway transportation fund. And at the same time, they didn't give enough budget to that area to fix the failing infrastructure. They gave enough budget to it to keep the existing projects going.
Yeah, this is the same thing they did in the extraordinary measures, by the way, when the Congress hadn't passed the budget and they didn't know what they were going to do to prevent the shutdown. They took a lot of money out of the pension funds. And some of that money has been paid back and some of it has not. And now they're taking more out for the highway program. There are issues.
Well, there's a simple economic fact here. We're burning less gasoline, and we have a fixed, and we've had inflation over the last 10 to 20 years. And a combination of those two means that the percentage of the economy that's being paid to keep the roads functional.
Let's put this in correct context.
It's shrinking.
We're burning less gasoline per mile driven.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually burning more gasoline now than we were 20 years ago by a substantial amount.
Right.
But per mile driven, which is what if you're looking at a highway repair job, you don't care what your gas mileage is. You care how many miles are driven by cars because that's the wear rate. That's, you know, it's like sandpaper on the road, only it's rubber. And
it's where the rubber meets the road.
Though think of the traction you would have if you had sandpaper on your tires. Anyway,
you really wouldn't have much because sandpaper slides on concrete.
Right, and the price per gallon is a fixed number. It's not a percentage. If it were a percentage,
not the price per gallon, the tax.
The tax is per gallon. It's a fixed number.
If it was a percentage, we'd be doing just fine. Right.
If it were a percentage, then as we have purchased more gasoline and we're driving more, that percentage would bring in more money. As it is, we are buying a certain number of gallons, and we're buying more gallons than we were, so the budget is bigger, but we're driving a lot more, which means that even though the budget's bigger, it's not enough to keep up with the wear and tear on the highways.
But by the time you factor in inflation since the last time we raised the pennies per gallon rate, we are getting about a quarter less per gallon now than we were then, and we're driving a lot more miles.
Right.
And when you look at that, there's only one, and folks, to me, it's a very obvious solution. There's actually two solutions, one of which Texas rejected out of hand. One solution is to have new highways built by private companies and charge tolls.
Right.
Which was the Trans-Texas Corridor concept and was rejected. The Texas people proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the concept of free enterprise corporations
not here
running highways was unacceptable. We must have socialist highways.
Right.
And funny, the right wing wanted the socialist highways to continue. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, so the socialist highways, then, if we're going to all use those highways at the rate that we're using them, and we want them maintained and widened and improved, which is, by the way, what the Trans-Texas Corridor, anti-Trans-Texas Corridor people said they wanted.
Right. We've already paid taxes on it. We might as well use the thing that we already have. That's what they're saying.
But we're going to have to raise the tax on per gallon, pennies per gallon. And actually, it'd be really simple. Put a percentage number on that figure.
Right.
And just stick a percentage on there as opposed to the pennies. Let the engineers say, here's how much money we need to fix the decaying roadways and bring everything up to speed, and throw that percentage on there, and if we use more gasoline, then they get more money.
Yeah, this is an area that our infrastructure in the United States is suffering, and our trade is based on infrastructure. We need to get this fixed. It is something that is not a maybe we should. This is the result, and I'm going to give you some things that people think of as pie in the sky. They think, oh, this is, you know, science fiction or whatever. When Amazon is talking about making deliveries with drones, and drones are just a remote control vehicle. I don't know why we're all calling them drones now, but because they're not autonomous yet. When we're talking about avoiding the road system, avoiding the expense of driving, the gasoline, the time of getting from one place to another, and using a maybe semi-autonomous drone to take a package to a house because it's cheaper, it means our infrastructure is failing and we're having to come up with other technology to do it. If we had good infrastructure, if we had a good system design, it would be a lot less expensive to deliver products. It would be a lot less time-consuming to get back and forth to work. That's just the reality of the world. And we're almost out of time for this hour. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about next hour. I wanted to talk about free trade and TTIP and all kinds of fun stuff like that.
TTIP.
Sure. TTIP, yeah.
Is that like if you go to have tea, you leave a tip?
Something like that.
You'll have to explain that to me.
Oh, yeah. It's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Pact.
Ooh.
Yeah, there you go. You've been explained.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Ecuador, who's just signed a free trade agreement with the EU, and we're going to talk about Ukraine a bit because...
Ukraine?
No, Ukraine.
Oh, okay.
Not Ukraine.
All right.
So if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
During the week, there are actual real people that answer that phone, but during the week,
very nice people,
weekends, too. We have voicemail, and you can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. Or you can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Personal Wealth Coach.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.